So, all right. So last class, I tried to give you a little bit of motivation and inspiration about why you want to learn as much quantum mechanics as you possibly can. And then we got into starting to write down a series of postulates that will allow us to have a mathematical framework within which we can describe systems. I gave you the first piece of this operational framework. So the first piece was preparation of the system. So the idea is that we have a control knob, which is our choice to decide how to prepare the system. So for example, suppose you have an oven and you fill it up with cesium atoms, the control, and you then poke a hole in the oven and you turn the knob that controls the temperature, for example. It can be, if you're preparing an atom in a trap, it can be a laser setting, which describes how you're going to rotate the internal states of the atom. It can be any of the ways, any of the quantum systems you've learned about. So obviously this is a theorist's oversimplification, just to talk about one control knob. Typically there's more than one control knob in an experimental device. There's a go button which starts the experiment. So you set the knob, step one. Step two, press the go button. Step three, which is optional, is to adjust a transformation. So clearly there's going to be some do-nothing transformation, which is going to be some setting, like maybe the setting on the left. Step four is, well, you should probably do this in advance of pressing the go button. So let me change that order. Okay, step one, adjust these three control knobs. Step two, press the go button. And then step three is read out the pointer. So the pointer is the outcome you detect in the experiment. So what can be happening inside this box is a lot of different things, and we're not going to worry for now about the details of what's happening inside the box, but just the fact that this is the kind of meta-level description of how we talk about quantum systems. Right, so the emphasis here is that the system itself is this invisible thing. So the system is the invisible object represented by dashed lines here and here, and possibly if we allow it to exit the measurement device, then also here. The quantum state is not the system. The quantum state is a description of this control knob. All right, that's the thing you have to learn. All right, the quantum state is not this, it's this. And it takes a really long time to appreciate why that's significant. I'm going to ask you to start thinking about that and slowly try and digest the idea. And I'll give you several examples throughout the class of why we need to make that move. Yes?
So when you mean that you measure the system, you're saying that the Hilbert space is what comes out?
No, the Hilbert space does not do anything. Okay, the Hilbert space is a mathematical object on your notepad. The system is this invisible object. We have no access to it. It's not a Hilbert space. It's not a vector. It's not a point and phase space. It's something which we don't know what it is. That's the mystery of quantum mechanics. But there are incorrect ways to think about it, and that is to think that the system is the vector in the Hilbert space.
Okay, but when you say that the state is a little machine there, you mean that this, like, the density matrix is that thing, or your pure state is that thing?
What I mean is that when we... What I mean is this. Start thinking about quantum mechanics as a mathematical tool. It's a mathematical tool that allows you to predict not the outcome you will get, but what? Expectation values, which at a more primitive level, as we'll see later this lecture, is just a probability. Quantum states predict probabilities of pointer positions. That's what they do. Which quantum state you're going to use is going to depend on which knob setting you use. So the quantum state, it is a description of the knob setting, which in turn allows you to predict the probability of the pointer. And all this stuff you shouldn't worry about, or you fall into a deep chasm that from which you may never return. Okay? So this is the conceptual distinction. And now someone after class asked me, why don't you use the word, okay, what was my postulate one? That right, so postulate one, which we'll recap. An ideal preparation procedure is described by a Hilbert space vector. Called a pure state. Okay, so I didn't say the system is a Hilbert space vector. All right. It's what we're describing with the Hilbert space vector. The Hilbert space vector is the wave function from wave mechanics. So the wave function from wave mechanics describes a preparation procedure. How did I eject this particle from my box? Okay, so it's describing the knob setting, which determines the inner workings of how I ejected the system. Okay, so why do I avoid the word quantum state? Okay, so I'll get into this now. This is probably too early. I'm going to do it anyways. Okay, so why is it best to avoid the term quantum state? Okay, the answer, because it is confusing. Specifically, it evokes the wrong connotation. With the uninitiated. Okay, so let me give you an example of what I mean. Suppose that you guys know what a shell game is, right? So a shell game, you're walking in the streets of New York, you'll see some guy with a cardboard box and three playing cards, slightly bent, and one of them is a queen and the other two are whatever. Say they're, you know, threes. And he says, look, I'll bet you $5. You bet $1, I'll give you $5 back if you can figure out where the queen is. And you say, sure, that's pretty good odds. I have 1 in 3 chance if I just pick randomly. And so then you go and say, sure, you put down your dollar, he shows you the queen, he shuffles the cards really fast, and then you guess where the queen is, and you're wrong. Most of the time, all right? All right, so it's a sleight of hand trick, which makes you think the wrong card is the queen. And your best bet is actually to guess randomly because they're good at their job. So now, how will we describe that situation? That situation where we have an uncertainty about the position of the queen, right? So the idea is you have, let's just draw it as 3 boxes. Okay, so let X be, X is the position of the queen. Let's number these boxes 1, 2, and 3, and then X then would be some element of 1, 2, or 3. So X is the position, by which I mean the physical state. That is, there's some fact of the world, which is the location of the queen, which the guy confirms to you after he's completed the trick. Okay, so that is the correct answer. But now suppose I realize that this guy's good at his job, so I shouldn't trust my instincts about which one is the queen. And I'm going to rely on the fact that I'm just going to pick randomly. So what does that mean? So now I've used the word physical state to talk about this quantity X. Well, now ultimately, if I have no certainty, or let's say if I have complete uncertainty, about the location uncertainty about, let me make this even stronger. If I have uncertainty about the physical state, which is, i.e., the location of the queen, this is called follow the lady in some circles. Okay, so if I have complete uncertainty about the physical state, then I'm going to use a different kind of object to describe the situation. I'm going to use a probability vector, right? So then I say I have a probability vector P, which is an element of R3. Okay, so here we have R3. Okay, so this is 1, 2, and 3. Three different physical locations. Okay, so this dot means queen is at 1. Is at location 1. Here the queen is at location 2. Etc. All right. So now we have something which we draw, this triangle, which we draw, which are the set of possible probabilistic descriptions of this three-state system. Right? Anyone know what that's called? So the one thing that people don't get enough of in undergrad, physicists don't get enough of in undergrad, is probability theory. If you try to understand quantum mechanics without understanding probability theory, it's a very difficult task. So it's called the simplex. Okay, this is called the simplex. And it's the geometry, it's this plane intersected by the XY, YZ, and ZX planes, which corresponds to the set of possible probability distributions. The set of allowed values of P, where P is equal to P1, P2, P3, and each PI is an element of 0, 1, actually, sorry, that's incorrect, of 0, 1. So it can take on the continuous set of values between 0, 1, and the sum of the PIs adds to 1. It's a probability vector. So the simplex is the subspace of R3. Sorry, in general you have, so if P is an element of RD, a D-dimensional, okay, so this, the notation for this is delta 2, then the simplex is delta D minus 1, which is a subset of RD. So in this case, our simplex is delta 2. Why 2 instead of 3? Because there's only two independent parameters. The third is fixed by normalization. So if I'm in a D, if you play Dungeons and Dragons and you have a 20-sided die, then D is 20, and the simplex is delta 19. Okay, so there's, okay, now in practice you assume that the die is evenly weighted so that all outcomes are equally probable, but let's relax that assumption and you have a weighted die. So you don't know what the probability of the different 20 outcomes are. Okay, so now the point is this. When I have uncertainty about the physical state, I use a different kind of object to describe the situation, to describe the preparation procedure. The person playing the shell game against me has performed a preparation procedure, and I want to describe the situation after that preparation procedure. And so what I do is I assign a probability, and that probability is a state, okay? So this probability vector is a state of uncertainty. Not a physical state. Okay, so this object P, it's not a property of the cards or of the world, it's a property of what's happening in my brain. Suppose that I notice that one of the cards has a little bit of damage on it, and he's shuffling the cards. But suppose the card that's damaged is not the queen. Then I'm going to have a little bit of an advantage. I'm not going to assign the probability 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, but I'm going to assign the probabilities 1/2, 1/2, 0. My friend who's standing next to me might not have noticed that the card is damaged. So that friend is going to assign probability 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. A third person there might think that their eyes are faster than this guy's hands, and they might assign a Kronecker delta function to the state, believing that the queen is in a particular location. So we have three different agents, and each of those three agents is assigning a different state to describe the system. The problem here is the word state evokes in most people, most physicists, the word state evokes the notion of physical state. So when you think about quantum states, you say, oh, that's the physical system. The quantum state is the set of properties of this invisible object. But you have to stop thinking that way and open your mind to thinking about the quantum state as a description of the preparation procedure, which leaves you with uncertain knowledge about the physical properties of the system. So you need to start thinking about the quantum state as a description of your knowledge, a description of the uncertainty you have about the outcomes of measurements. So there's these two different notions of state here. You have to start struggling to understand how to apply when you're reasoning about the use of quantum mechanics. How did that help? Was it confusing? It should be confusing, but it takes time. All right, so any questions about that? Yes.
So the reason that we actually discuss these different states, as you say, is that because we assign different probabilities to these some people may say, like, oh, I just watched better, so I have more information, so I know the state better, so I just assign the delta function. But this is all very classical. Can we still do this?
Yeah. So let me just interrupt you. So this is what normally happens in discussions like this. We make this distinction between physical state and state of knowledge or state of uncertainty. And then people will engage me in discussion and use the word state without an adjective. So then I can't understand which state you're referring to, right? This is the whole problem, right? Without an adjective, the word state is very confusing. All right, so now can you repeat your question with that in mind?
So we assign different states in this different. We assign different physical states. I think is the thing that you mentioned to the same kind of system because of the information that we have. But can we still speak this way when we go back to the quantum?
Yes.
When we don't know whether or not this information actually exists.
I think literally just here, look, you can put this whole thing in a box, you know, and then it exits the cards, okay? The invisible thing could be the three cards inside the box, all right? We've made no statements about what that dotted line is other than we're specifically not going to make statements about it. So the point is often you can be describing a system using quantum mechanics and it's a completely classical system. Because you haven't done your job right, it's decohered or whatever. In which case, what happens? The quantum state reduces to a probability distribution describing the sets of possible properties. If you're thinking about the quantum state as associated with the specific physical properties of the system, then you get a disconnect. All right. So this is just, let me just set this aside because you guys, yes, Aggie.
Can I just, before you do set this aside, can I ask one more question?
Of course. Yeah, so that's a great question, and that's a tricky question. So it turns out if we start talking about density operators and mixed states, then yes, you can have inconsistent mixed state assignments. But you cannot all be correct and have different pure state assignments of the same system. So the analogy breaks down at that level, and so you're kind of pushing the boundaries of this analogy by, you know, demanding The point is, when you have three agents and they assign different states, different probability states, classically, more than one of them can be correct, right? So if the queen is in the third location and, you know, person one assigns uniform probability, then he's not making a mistake. Person two applies uniform probability in the last two boxes, is not making a mistake. If person three says, oh, it's definitely here, then they're making a mistake. So they have an incorrect state assignment in that case. Or if, you know, someone says the probability is concentrated on these two blocks, they have an incorrect state assignment. So there's a subtle issue about, can you have more than one state assignment that's correct when you're talking about probability theory versus when you're talking about quantum systems? And that's something Chris Fuchs has actually written about. And I'm not really prepared to give a good answer just now. Any other questions? Yeah.
Can this framework be used for situations where we don't have control of the preparation procedure?
Yeah, so we're going to look at generalized. So here we're describing ideal situations where we assume we have optimal control of the system. The situation is not ideal, and this control knob, you know, if the wires connecting the control knob to the workings inside the box are broken, or, you know, that's a silly example, but you know what I mean. If the control isn't perfect, then we need a more general structure, which is going to be this density operator that I introduced last class. So for now, we're just looking at the ideal case, and then we'll look at how to describe realistic systems where you have imperfect control. So that's analogous to the situation when I have no idea where the queen is, I assign the uniform probability distribution. So in the quantum setting, there's a unique density operator, the identity operator, which when normalized is identity over the dimension of the system. And that predicts uniform probabilities for every measurement outcome, which means you have no knowledge of what the system, of what the outcomes of any measurement will be. So the identity density operator, which we'll see, corresponds to no knowledge. And a pure state corresponds to optimal knowledge. The important point is that classically, we think of optimal knowledge of where the queen is a Kronecker delta assignment, right? I'm saying optimal knowledge is delta I2. I know for sure that the system is in spot 2. Or sorry, maybe I should call it delta. How do you denote a Kronecker function again? Is it delta? You have a variable x and it takes on three values, and you say, well, it's equal to the value 2. Is it just delta x2? Is that how you write it? Why can I not remember this? Is this right? Yeah, okay, good. So this would be perfect knowledge. In the quantum setting, the pure state, now this is my belief, this is not a scientific fact. The pure state corresponds to the optimal knowledge is not complete knowledge. You always have some uncertainty. And that's one of the innovations of quantum mechanics. But that is not a scientific fact, that is an opinion. Okay, so keep that in mind. Okay, good. So all I'm asking you to do here is not accept my interpretation, but rather just open your mind to the possibility of thinking of quantum states in these two different ways. And I think that will give you an enriching ability to reason through things that seem otherwise paradoxical. Am I doing this? Yeah, when I mean quantum state, I mean the mathematical tool we're using to describe the knob on the device, which allows us to predict probabilities. So let's just not make any statements about the physical properties at all, and we can still do quantum mechanics. In fact, we don't even need to talk about physical properties other than the knob settings, which we directly access, and the pointer positions, which we directly read. Those are the only physical properties we need to talk about to use the full power of quantum mechanics to predict facts about the world. Yeah?
So if we have some, let's say if we have two different devices that can control the control the spin of a particle, then if the device is something very different, should we express two quantum states with different Hilbert space factor? I mean, because we are using different procedure.
Yeah, every procedure is associated with a okay. There are many procedures that are described by the same state vector. So the procedure of, you know, adjusting the knob, whether or not, you know, I'm wearing yellow or red socks, okay? The knob setting is the same. It doesn't matter what color my socks are. I'm going to use the same vector. There are other things that do matter. So if there's something inside the box that's a little bit different for one knob setting, you have two boxes, same knob setting, something inside the box is a little bit different, you're going to get generally two different procedures. And so you need different quantum states to describe those two different procedures. Okay, so we wanted to talk a little bit more about examples of Hilbert space. Okay, let's start with the one you know best, which is L2R. Okay, this is the space of square integrable functions. Okay, so let psi and phi be elements of L2R. Okay, so then what we have is a Hilbert space is an inner product space, so we have to specify the inner product. So the inner product between psi and phi, which can be written as inner product between psi and phi, is equal to the integral over dx minus infinity to infinity complex conjugate of psi times phi of x. Okay, so then we have square integrable implies that psi psi, which is equal to the integral over dx psi of x, which is equal to integral over dx psi x squared. Its square integrable means this integral gives me a finite value, so it can't be infinity. Okay, so a function psi is square integrable if it satisfies this condition. Let me say this more correctly. Psi is square integrable if if psi is square integrable and phi is square integrable, then what do we know about the inner product of psi and phi? It's also finite via Cauchy-Schwarz. Excellent. So the fact that psi and phi are elements of this set of square integrable functions means that their inner products are also finite. This is a very well-behaved space. What is this space? It's third-year quantum mechanics. It's wave mechanics, okay? So all of wave mechanics is, occurs in H equals L2R. Well, I shouldn't say L2R, I should say L2RN. All right, so here psi and phi are functions of a single variable, x. So that's what the R refers to. Okay, so x is an element of R. So what this means is I have one particle in one dimension, in 1D. So Rn, this is one particle in n dimensions, or n particles in one dimension, or n over 3 particles in 3 dimensions, etc. Okay, the same Hilbert space is used to describe all of these situations. So if I'm doing a wave function in 3 dimensions, a single particle in 3 dimensions, I use R3. If I'm talking about a particle in a 2-dimensional box, I use R2. So the R refers to the coordinates. So the set of coordinates are live in a real space of a certain number of dimensions. And the wave function lives in this space L2R. Yes? Yes. So here's the funny thing. All infinite dimensional separable Hilbert spaces are isomorphic. So actually, L2R3 is isomorphic to L2R. It's isomorphic to L2R50. It's just a matter of how you pack your coordinate system. I think there's some example of this. It's called the Hilbert Space Hotel or something like that. Does anyone know what that is? Hilbert Space Hotel? Come on, one of you guys should know this. You can expect me to know everything. Hilbert Space Hotel, it's something like, it expresses the fact that if you have a real variable, a continuous variable, that has as much information as 2 continuous variables. So somehow if I have x and y and they're both real numbers, that's the same amount of information as having just z, which is a real number. And I can show that by an encoding. I can take z and I can write z out, all of its decimals of precision, and then I take x to be every other digit in the decimal in that string, and I take y to be every other digit in that decimal string. Because it's infinitely long, I can pack as much information as I want in there by just reinterpreting what the different digits mean in this very long, infinitely long string. Okay, so the point is 2 real variables is the same as 1 real variable. And that you're not giving me any advantage if you're letting me use 2 real variables to describe something. I can just adopt an encoding and put all that information into 1 real variable because it's infinite information. So similarly, that's what's going on here. But it's more concealed because it's less obvious because we're dealing with this additional structure of square integrability and so on. If you didn't understand that, don't worry about it. You don't need to worry about that. I was just trying to answer your question.
Basically, that's why you need for it to be separable, right? You need to map basis elements into basis elements.
Oh, you're talking about separability now. So the point is, there's a natural way to divide up your coordinates. So if I have 2 particles in 3 dimensions, it's natural then, if I have 2 particles in 3D, then naturally I'm going to have some variable z, which is going to be xa, ya, za, xb, yb, zb. Well, let's not call it z, let's call it omega. So the natural Hilbert space the the natural encoding of the information is to use L2 R3 cross L2 R3. L2 R3 is actually equal to L2 R cross L2 R cross L2 R. And this L2 R3 is also the same thing. So I have 6 copies of L2R, which is in fact isomorphic to 1 copy of L2R, because we're dealing with infinities. But this is the natural way to do it. We assign 1 copy of L2R to every coordinate, every degree of freedom. Okay, let's look at something a little bit simpler. Okay, another example. H equals C2. Okay, so this is a two-dimensional complex vector space. Okay, so this is useful. This is this describes, for example, a spin half particle. Okay, so then we have some wave function chi. Well, I shouldn't call it a wave function, it's a vector. Which is an element of then C2. So then I can write chi as a two-component object, alpha, beta. Okay, we have the fact that we're gonna have normalization, which is that chi squared is equal to 1, which implies that alpha squared plus beta squared is equal to 1. I should probably say more about the infinite dimensional Hilbert space. There's a lot more you could say about it. Let me just digress a bit here. So because this space is separable, it means that psi can be expressed as a sum. I kind of mentioned this last class. Phi L. So the important thing is that this is a sum from 1 to infinity or 0 to infinity, depending how you like to count. This is an L, where phi L is an orthonormal basis. And so because it's an orthonormal basis for a separable Hilbert space, that means it's a countable set. So here we can have, when we write down a vector in terms of components, that means we're implicitly assuming a basis, which is a representation. So here we can choose any basis. So let's just call these basis elements 0 and 1. And then chi would be equal to alpha 0 plus beta 1. So, pop quiz. I'm thinking about this operational procedure. Someone promises me that the system, the invisible system that's being spat out, is an electron in one dimension, confined to one dimension. No, let's make it a little bit harder. An electron confined to 2 dimensions, okay? We know that that electron has a spin half, and there are no other relevant degrees of freedom. What Hilbert space do I need? I want to assign a vector to the different vectors to the different settings of my control knob. So So my quantum state is going to be describing the different settings of my control knob. What is the Hilbert space of allowed quantum states to describe my control knob setting? Exactly. Okay. So example for an electron with spin 1/2 confined to a two-dimensional plane, the Hilbert space is equal to L2 R2. You said times, the correct word is tensor product, which is a kind of multiplication for Hilbert spaces, times C2. And now we're going to study this structure in detail. How many of you have seen the tensor product structure already? You covered it? Have you seen it? I mean, how many of you feel comfortable like you know everything you need to know about the tensor product? Only a few, okay. You'll be discussing the tutorial? Okay, good. So you just have to tell me where to stop then, so I was going to give some discussion about it. Okay, good. Okay, I think I'll skip the other examples. You guys look a little bit bored, so I'll move on to some new stuff. Yeah. I think we can treat spinner and spins the same. They can be coupled. You can correlate or entangle the spin degree of freedom with the electron. I mean, they're independent degrees of freedom, but you can have states which entangle those two degrees of freedom.
Sure.
You can have like a direction. So maybe I missed your question.
I don't know. I just don't understand. Like, if you want to do, like, you can always do that if you're doing quantum mechanics. That's what we always do. But I never saw how you can go from, for example, from spinner space.
From relativistic to non-relativistic. Yeah, okay, that's a non-trivial question. I've seen that done once in a quantum field theory course where the person looked at the non-relativistic limit and showed that you recover the usual non-relativistic properties of spin half. But I don't think I could reproduce the argument off the top of my head. Okay. Good. So again, this is pretty basic stuff, but let's make sure we establish a notation and we're all on the same page. So let's talk about ideal measurement. Okay, so let A be a self-adjoint operator. Okay, then A admits a spectral decomposition. So we can write A as a sum over L, ALPL. Where the set AL are the eigenvalues of A, and the set PL are orthogonal projection operators. Or projectors for short. So we have PL PK is equal to Kronecker delta. Okay, that looks more familiar. PL. And an important condition is if orthogonal projection operators are also self-adjoint. Okay, so each PL projects onto the possibly degenerate eigenspace associated with eigenvalue AL. Which is always a real number because A is self-adjoint. Okay, so if AL is M-fold degenerate, then we can choose a set of orthonormal vectors L, ML such that PL can be expressed as a sum over ML from 1 to M of L, ML, L, ML. So these states ML span the eigenspace that PL projects onto. Having done this lecture a few years, it's almost every class I need exactly 7 boards. I mean, yeah, and so I'm always one short. All right. Okay, so now anybody questions about that mathematical structure? This is all pretty basic for you guys. Okay, good. So now we can state our postulate. Postulate 2. An ideal measurement procedure is described. Remember, we're describing the knob and the pointer here, is described by a self-adjoint operator A such that property 1 the set of physically observable outcomes are prescribed by the eigenvalues AL and 2, the probability of any outcome AL is prescribed by Oh, sorry. I should say, given preparation psi, actually, let me call it rho. Given preparation rho equal to psi psi is prescribed by the Born rule. Trace of rho PL. All right, I'll let you guys absorb that. Okay, so remarks. So, what's the best way it is? So one gives us the novel structural aspects of quantum mechanics. Okay, so for example, the discrete spectrum of hydrogen or any atom for that matter, the band gap structure of solids or semiconductors. These are all properties. These are properties that follow just from understanding the spectral decomposition of the relevant observable. For example, the energy of the system. Okay, this is the quantization of degrees of freedom. Okay, the quantization of spin. Etc. Okay, and the second part, part two, of our postulate two, gives us the statistical nature of quantum mechanics. So, for example, the fact that we have uncertainty about outcomes of tests. Outcomes of measurements, which is novel relative to, say, Newtonian mechanics. Okay, two is called the Born rule. So Max Born, in the early heady days of quantum mechanics in the late 20s, was the first person to kind of point out that the way that we connect the wave function of Schrodinger to experimental observation is to use essentially this rule. And he actually got it wrong. So he won a Nobel Prize for this. And in his paper, he had that the probability was proportional to the wave function, and then realized that the wave function was complex and that it had to be the magnitude squared. It had to be the magnitude squared of the wave function. And that actually appears as a footnote added in proof of the paper. So that's pretty amazing. Did you already tell them this? I can tell from the lack of. All right, good. Okay, so any questions? And I can say some more about this. Maybe we should recover the familiar formulas of wave mechanics. So let me move over here. Okay, so what you normally, okay, how do expectation values, fit into this picture? Okay, so the expectation value of a self-adjoint operator is defined as psi A psi, which if we write out A's spectral decomposition, then this is equal to a sum over L. Well, let me do it in baby steps. Psi sum over L AL PL psi. But this is the bra is a linear functional, which means it satisfies linearity, which means we can bring the sum outside. So we can write this as sum over L AL psi PL psi. And then note we have trace of rho PL is equal to the trace of psi psi PL, which is equal to psi PL psi. Okay, so that means this is equal to the sum over L AL trace of PL psi psi. Okay, so what is an expectation value? It's the probabilities of each eigenspace occurring weighted by the eigenvalue. Okay, so if we do a measurement, okay, what does that mean? So now I have my operational setting up here. Okay, so I press the go button, the light goes off. I've preset my knobs to be measuring this particular observable. So I set the knob to measure A. The light goes off, the pointer goes to some position. The position of the pointer is lowercase a sub L. Basically, it's L. So L is an index, which is an index for the different pointer positions. Everyone with me on this? Okay, so L is an index for the different pointer positions. So what that means is if I do the experiment once, I get one outcome L. L equals 3. That's not this. Now I do the experiment again, I get another outcome, L equals 5. I do the experiment again, I get another outcome, L equals 7. The outcomes are random. So what I do is I collect a histogram, the probability of each L, and I get something like this. So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this is the probability of 1. This is the probability of 2, and so on. That's my raw data. So this is my histogram for an ensemble of repetitions. Ensemble of repetitions of the operational procedure in figure 1. Okay, so the expectation value is not associated, notice it's not associated with any of the physical properties. Okay, remember I said, what are the physical properties? The knob settings and the pointer position. Those are physical properties. They exist in space-time. The expectation of A does not exist at a point in space-time. It describes the weighted average. Each of these indices for L is associated with some eigenvalue. which I've written down in my notebook based on the knob setting. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to collect these probabilities by repeating the experiment thousands of times, pressing the go button thousands of times, and measuring the pointer position thousands of times. I collect this histogram of data, and then I calculate the expectation of A is equal to the sum over L PL AL, where PL is equal to the probability of L, which is this object here. This is PL. Okay, so now if I tell you to do this experiment and you go to the lab, you come back to me and you say, aha, the expectation value of A is, 6.2 units, whatever units A is in, kilograms or meters, okay? You say 6.2 meters. And then I say, well, what was the probability of getting the outcome L equals 4, which is associated with, say, 4 meters? And you say, well, I don't know. I threw away the raw data. I just calculated the answer and threw away my notebook. I say, well, that's a problem, because the raw data is kind of what's interesting. So once you specify the expectation value, you're throwing away all this information, which is the raw information you get out of the experiment. So the point of that story is that the kind of the relevant empirical primitives, if you know what that means, are these things, probabilities of L, which is our Born rule over here. This is the raw quantum data. And if you're giving me an expectation value, that's a derived quantity. If I later decide I want to measure the operator A prime, which is equal to a sum over L AL prime, but that shares the same projectors with A, so the only difference between A prime and A is that there are different eigenvalues, then I can compute A prime from the raw data. But if you just give me the expectation of A, then I'll have no idea what the expectation of A prime is. Okay, so this is why the expectation value is kind of it's a less important quantity. It's a derived quantity. It's not a fundamental quantity. All right, any questions about that? Yes. That's interesting. Never thought of it that way. So you're arguing that if I want to talk about, well, I'm not sure, because completeness has to do with infinite limits. And I'm never going to do an infinite number of experiments. So to describe any finite experimental procedure, I don't think I need completeness in the norm. I think it's really just a mathematical constraint so that we can prove certain theorems. I don't think it's strictly necessary to be able to talk about. But I mean, if you want to talk about the abstract infinite limit of these probabilities that we get are just estimates of the true probabilities, because we only collect finite statistics. Yeah, so maybe you're onto something there. If you want to talk about, like, you know, the ideal probabilities, which are the limit of infinite statistics, and we have a continuous continuous setting where that knob corresponds to a continuous dial, then in any given run, I'm not going to have exactly the same real number, so I'm going to get some small perturbation to what the preparation is. Yeah, I'd have to think about that. It's an interesting point. Maybe, because I've always wondered kind of why operationally you need to demand completeness in the norm, and I've never had a good answer for that, so that might be one way to do that. Any other questions? Yes?
On the blackboard, under note, how do you get the last line?
Over here?
Yeah.
How do I go from here to here?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good question. That's kind of a shorthand trick, but let's remember the definition of the trace. The trace of some object means I pick any orthonormal basis, Let's call it M. Okay, so this is the definition of the trace. So where phi M is any orthonormal basis. Now I think what we do is we say, let's choose an orthonormal basis, the first element of which is psi, and the other elements I don't care about because they're orthogonal to psi. Okay, so now let's choose phi 1 to be equal to psi. And then every phi m not equal to 1 is going to be orthogonal to psi because it's an orthonormal basis. And then I insert this here. I'm going to have a sum over m phi m psi pl phi m. The only term that, because of this orthogonality relation, the only term that survives is m equals 1, which is phi 1 is equal to psi. So then this is equal to, well, it's equal to that. Okay, we're ready for unitary transformations. You guys look really bored. I'm probably telling you things you already know, maybe things that Aggie even covered. So let me pick up the pace a little bit. We have 10 more minutes. We'll talk about ideal transformations. I guess this board is okay, right? Okay, so. So we'll just skip right to the postulate. Lots of this piece. Postulate 3. And this is going to be our last postulate, I guess. Ideal transformations are generated by a linear operator U such that the wave function at time, ideal transformations, I should say, in time, although t doesn't have to be time, it can be any coordinate, where u satisfies a funny version of the Schrodinger equation, which is the Schrodinger equation expressed in terms of U. With H a self-adjoint operator representing the energy observable, with t a real parameter representing time, And we have the initial condition. When T2 equals T1, which represent no time having elapsed, we have the identity operator. So if no time has elapsed, the evolution operator is identity. So as we discussed the previous class, H is given to us by other physics. So laws describing forces between systems. So it's the end of the postulate. So we have the general solution. The general solution of this partial differential equation can be expressed in a compact form that you've hopefully seen before, which is this time-ordered exponential. This is all divided by h bar. And so this is time ordering. You can think of this as dividing H into a bunch of piecewise continuous segments, and then we put each of those segments ordered from right to left in time. This is all standard stuff. And we need that because the different terms will not commute. Because H is in general a function of time, it doesn't commute with itself at different points in time. Okay, so, but if we are in the lucky situation that H is time independent, then we have a simpler expression, which is that U of T is equal to just the exponential operator of that form. Okay, lastly, I'll mention that postulate 3 implies Schrodinger's equation. Which is in the form you normally see it. I'm running out of space here. I'll move up here, I guess. So postulate 3 implies IH bar d psi of t by dt is equal to h of t psi of t. Okay. All right, I have some stuff here about the Heisenberg picture, but you guys all know that, right? Anyways, you can check it in the notes. So we'll figure out a strategy for distributing these. Any questions about that? So I think we're done. I'm not certain we're done with the postulates. But we're pretty close to done. So now the rest is just applications and studying the structure. Any questions? Do you feel like anything's missing from our postulates? Yeah.
Two. That doesn't imply a wave function collapse, does it?
No. No, we don't have wave function collapse yet. So I'm going to derive it for you. Kind of. So, look, I mean, here's the kind of what I'm sweeping under the rug. I'm not giving you H. I'm not telling you, my postulates aren't going to tell you if you put, you know, 10 to the 23 cesium atoms in an oven that's 1 meter by 1 meter, you poke a hole in the wall that's has, you know, 1 micrometer radius, and I heat the oven up to 4,000 degrees Kelvin, what density operator do I assign to the particles that are emitted through that pinhole? Adding a rule about the collapse of the wave function isn't going to answer that question. You need other physics to tell you how to describe the knob setting. Now, the knob setting on my operational procedure is all of that, right? It's a prescription of what the size of the oven is, the size of the hole, the temperature. That's what the knob is doing. So really, you need 3 knobs for that, okay? Now, I'm not giving you that. So we need either empirical information. We can actually test and see what the state is describing the stuff that's coming out of that pinhole. Or we can use other physics to derive it from first principles, like, you know, quantum statistical mechanics, and whatever else. We have to do some physics to figure that out. So now, the update rule, which we'll discuss in depth, is saying, look, if I do this measurement on the system, what is the state I get after the measurement? So why should my postulates tell you how to describe the state after that measurement any more than they should tell you what the density operator is for the state of the particles coming out of that pinhole? The point is, both of those questions are answered through other physics, through either empirical tests or deducing properties by appealing to laws of conservation of energy and momentum and things like that. So, I mean, this is something I struggled with for like 10 years, by the way, is like, you know, should this be a postulate or not? I'm still not 100% convinced, but I think that is a question that corresponds to other physics does the job of answering that question. And maybe you can convince me otherwise, but we'll discuss it and I'll tell you everything I know and then we can have a debate about it, which, because I'd like to come to some conclusion at some point. Where my conclusion now is provisional. So I'll look forward to that. Other questions? Yes?
You said the Hilbert space factor describes the procedure, but like in case of example, you provide like the electron that's in 2D. Mm-hmm. Like the Hilbert space is constructed like without any information about how we prepare, but it is based on a physical system. So like, I'm confused how. If I try to understand everything in terms of preparation, I thought that how to construct it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. That's a good question. So let me try and give an answer. Now, you know, let me, instead of having one knob, remember, three real variables are the same as one real variable in the sense that I can pack all that information in. Similarly, one continuous knob is the same as three continuous knobs. Okay. So now let me expand my continuous knob into three continuous knobs. The first two continuous knobs pick out things like, am I talking about an electron or a proton? The other knob picks out what dimension of the space is. Just like in this example, one knob is determining the size of the oven, another knob is determining the size of the pinhole. I keep those knobs fixed, and that determines my Hilbert space. Okay? How many atoms do I put into the oven, things like that. And then I have a third knob, and that knob controls the temperature of the oven. Now, if you know something about how to describe thermal states, you know that you get a one-parameter family of states, which are parameterized by the temperature. So that third knob is setting the temperature. So the first two knobs are setting the Hilbert space, what is the system I'm describing, and the third knob is setting the vector in the Hilbert space. Which is, again, an oversimplification, because really that third knob will be, again, a family of knobs that determine all kinds of properties, like what is the spatial wave function in which the electron is prepared, what is the spin state with which the electron is prepared, et cetera. So think of that set of knobs as really, so we're on the one hand, we're having a Hilbert space to describe a certain collection of the knobs, which is what is the physical system I'm creating, and another collection of knobs are how am I preparing that physical system. So it's all been compressed and simplified, and which makes it probably confusing. But so there's some advantage to just abstracting away everything, but there's also a disadvantage, which is you want to describe real world physics, you have to understand how does it map onto this picture. Does that help? All right, think about it. All right, you're probably all hungry. I don't want to stand between you and your lunch, so I'll speak with you again tomorrow.